Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Haley Bird-Wilt.
And in this episode, we're going to look at a topic that personally I've been wanting to broach for quite a while, which is how should the New Republic rebuild after the sequel trilogy? How should they learn from the failures of the old New Republic, I guess you can call it? How should they learn from the emergence of the First Order? What should they do? How should the new galactic government be set up? And of course, you know, as we record this, we're partway through season three of The Mandalorian, which has recently started to touch on similar issues for the original New Republic when it comes to how they want to set things up after the Empire. I'm sure we'll be talking about that in more detail once we see how that unfolds. But for now, let's focus on the era where we have a little bit more clarity, which is the sequel era. When those movies are over, we're going to need a new galactic government. What should it look like? So I want to talk first about probably the most hotly debated aspect of this, which is the military. We saw in The Force Awakens, the First Order was able to basically destroy the entire Republic military with one shot. And so the question here for the new Republic is, do they need to once again have some kind of permanent standing military? If so, should it be larger? Should it be more spread out? Or should we go back to a model that the Republic used for a while in the old Republic, which is basically individual star systems and sectors have militias that sort of deal with local threats, and the Republic can sort of call them into service when necessary. If you think about the National Guard in the United States, this would be a Star Wars version of that. So, Grace, maybe we can start with you. Should the New Republic have a bigger military, a different kind of military? What lessons can we learn from how things went down in the sequels?
All right, so first of all, I have to just give the caveat that by engaging with this conversation at all, that requires acknowledging the sequels as canon, which technically they are, but in my heart they're not. But for the purposes of this conversation, yes, the sequels are canon. Gah. but thinking about this is a really interesting question. I think fundamentally it comes down to the galaxy being just so frickin' big and how difficult it is to have a truly centralized government and centralized military under a system where there are just trillions of people and they're all in different planets with different cultures and different species, and there's just a lot happening there. So I think we saw in the Clone Wars era that having a centralized military, which is something worth talking about on its own, of basically a bunch of clone soldiers and then space wizard generals. But we saw that did not work out super duper well for the Republic. And admittedly, they were in the midst of a civil war. But I think it sort of underscored the difficulties of trying to impose your will over such a vast space with one military that is focused, concentrated from the quote-unquote center of the galaxy. So all of this is a very long way of saying I kind of like the National Guard idea. I think that who better to handle the specific issues of each system than the officials of that system. And for the most part, it's not like they're going to be dealing with galaxy-wide war stuff. They're just trying to survive in their own system. So I'm personally fine with having that sort of decentralized military. And if the new Republic is trying to learn from the old Republic and the new Republic, I think they may conclude that having some form of centralized military hasn't super worked out for them.
That's interesting. I mean, I look at the Clone Wars and I guess I see it a little differently. I mean, that was that was a unique situation where the whole thing was part of a grand plan, and so the Republic could never really win. I'm not sure I would look at that as an indication that a galactic military, you know, is incapable of achieving its objectives or is destined to, you know, turn into the Empire or destined to fail. I would probably suggest that just as the scope of the galaxy might make it challenging to have a galaxy-wide military, it also means that there are going to be more threats that span multiple sectors, multiple systems, where the Star Wars National Guard is not capable of handling it. And so we may not have another Galactic Civil War or another Clone Wars, but we're probably going to have things that are too big for the National Guards of various sectors to come together and deal with. And I think, you know, it's weird because, you know, we want to try to not think too much about the real world stuff because we're assuming for the sake of this conversation that we're using the history and the experience of the Star Wars galaxy. But the Star Wars galaxy shows us that when you're not prepared for the bad guys to come back, they can take advantage of that very easily. And if this government is going to be able to keep the peace and also figure out where the threats are, I think we do need a pretty big military. Like, I think in this galaxy, we need the Republic to be able to demonstrate to the citizenry that it's actually good for something. And for the most part, the tip of the spear of that is going to be security.
Yeah, I think one other thing that just came to me was in Andor, how we see the corporate security on Morlana 1 kind of subsumed into the Empire. I could see something sort of working out, like there's a larger umbrella military structure, and then potentially, not necessarily private contractors, but system-wide contractors that then work under that organization. But I don't know, I guess I'm just not as much of a Star Wars hawk as you, Eric.
When I come into this conversation, I guess I'm thinking about, like, what would I want if I were in charge of a planet? And I would not want to be involved in, like, a big galactic empire. And I guess part of, like, the necessitating event, and, you know, I'm not familiar with much of the expanded universe, so correct me if this is incorrect, Eric, but I assume that there has to be some degree of conquest to begin with, to even have these planets sort of forced to take orders from a centralized body of some kind. And, like, I don't know, I think that's the root of their problems. And I understand, like, the need for, like, defense, but there are ways, like, I was looking up to try to find there's some kind of sci-fi novel, and I couldn't find the name just now, but hopefully I'll find it and we can include it in the show notes, that like featured Kessler syndrome as a planetary defense, where, like, you can't get in, like, aliens cannot get into your planet because they have triggered, like, this cascading domino effect of debris in space that just, like, will take out your spacecraft on the way in. And, like, I don't know, I would probably want to do that. Like, if you're a planet with, like, and obviously this is assuming a lot, but if you have some stuff figured out, like keeping your environment clean and resource management, like, you don't necessarily need space travel, and you're sort of asking for trouble if you, like, engage. And, you know, that's sort of the premise of the three-body problem series, which is very cynical, and I didn't really enjoy it. But my, like, the best book in that series, which, I mean, in my opinion, was the second one, which sort of explores the dark forest theory of the universe. And it's like, if there's aliens, you don't want to let them know that you exist. Like, you don't want to broadcast your location to the aliens because, like, if they're intelligent enough to receive that, they're not going to take chances about your intentions. And so I don't know, when I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about taking it back to square one, maybe, like, and I get the free trade argument, like, maybe there's medications and, like, important, like, helpful things. And, but I don't know, I would much more lean towards, and you know, you see in the prequels too, like, the Empire theoretically is, or the Republic at that time theoretically is supposed to help enforce, like, human rights laws and, like, anti-slavery laws, which they weren't really living up to on, like, the Outer Rim. So, like, in my mind, it's like, if I were in charge, I would much prefer, like, a series of trade agreements that hinge on human rights, you know, meeting certain conditions. But that, again, that doesn't answer Eric's defense question. So I don't know. I don't have an answer.
Well, I do think that, you know, whatever the New Republic does in terms of collective security, there are definitely going to be those planets, as there have been throughout the history of the Star Wars galaxy, that just don't want to engage. They rebuff all efforts to bring them in. The Empire would not take no for an answer if they needed something from those planets. The Republic would typically leave them alone. I think we could probably assume the New Republic would also leave them alone. But I think you're definitely going to have planets like that where they say, we don't want to get involved. We're self-sustaining. We can figure everything out for ourselves. I it's not clear throughout either the canon or the expanded universe exactly how the Republic and then the New Republic spreads. You know, I don't think there's a ton of evidence that they're doing sort of Star Wars colonization where they're sort of taking planets over by force and saying you're now part of the Republic and you have to listen to us. I think that, you know, the Dark Forest thing, that's really interesting because it makes me think about why would a planet want to join the Republic? Are there benefits to being part of an association when it's a dangerous galaxy out there? And I think that's probably the pitch that they make. It's probably the pitch that the new Republic is also going to make, which is let's band together and do things collectively because we each have strengths that can augment our each other's weaknesses. And there are people out there who want to do you harm, they want to do me harm, and we can be, you know, more adept at defeating them if we work together. And that's how you get a coalition of any sort, whether it's a tribe or a city or a nation or a galactic government. So I think that's probably how that's happening. But, you know, when we talk about the military side of things, I mean, it's going to be a challenge no matter what they want to do. It's going to be a challenge to pull it off. I mean, it's expensive to maintain a standing military. There's actually a great Reddit thread that talks about why it's not so unrealistic that the New Republic decided to disarm after the Galactic Civil War. And one of the points is it's hard to justify having a huge military when you don't have a clear threat. And as we know, the First Order and the Imperial Remnant did a great job of not presenting a clear threat. Then you also have people worried that if we have a massive military, we're going to have a new dictatorship. Maybe some people looked at the fall of the Republic as a referendum on having a large military. I tend to think it's more a referendum on having a Sith Lord pulling the strings, you know, behind the scenes. But some people could say large military bad. That's how we got the Empire. You know, there's also the question of we had the war between the Resistance and the First Order, but how many people actually personally experienced that? One thing that I don't think the sequels do a good job of, and the ancillary material also doesn't do a good job of this, is giving us a sense of how widespread was that war? What percentage of the galactic population heard about it, felt it, was afraid of it? We don't really know. We see it in a very limited form, and, you know, the Resistance obviously doesn't mount a huge military force where they could be spanning, you know, massive portions of the galaxy. So are people afraid enough of another war that they're willing to say, let's have a military to protect us? I don't know how many people would actually fall into that category because we don't know how many people experienced it. So that's kind of a ramble there. But does anybody have any thoughts on, you know, whether that war would actually motivate people to say, yeah, let's pay for a big military because we don't want to see that again?
So I think all this is just raising really fascinating questions about what the purpose of a centralized galactic government even is. And listening to Haley and Eric talk about it, I don't know if I'm fully convinced that there does need to be a centralized government of the galaxy of some kind. But setting that aside, I think that kind of feeds into what you're saying, Eric, because, yeah, the First Order, that's what they're called, right? The First Order. I kept wanting to say New Order. I'm like, no, that's an 80s band. So the First Order have a Death Star 2.0 that's bigger and deathier than ever. But that does raise the question of how widespread is knowledge of Starkiller Base? And assuming that there is rapid communication across the galaxy, which we have to because all indications are that there is a network of rapid or simultaneous communication no matter where you are, I think there would be at the very least an awareness of, oh dang, they just blew up our literal capital. That's pretty crazy. So I think at the very least, everyone would be aware of the destruction of Hosnian Prime. But when we're talking about how much most of the galaxy would be involved in this, like, the First Order was in charge for just a hot second. They barely had any time to really exert any true control over the galaxy. At least the Empire had 20 years. First Order does not have 2 decades. So if I'm just a rando on some planet on the Outer Rim that's not Tatooine, because there's too much Tatooine, but if I'm just some rando and I see, well, they blew up the capital, like, oh dang, hope that doesn't affect me, but it probably wouldn't affect my everyday life, especially if the First Order is just a blip on the radar. If you're a 45-year-old, you will have lived through Old Republic, Empire, New Republic, First Order. Like, regime change is nothing new for you.
That's such a fascinating just fact, by the way, that I don't think, right, enough Star Wars fans think about how compressed all this is.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not very much time. And I think because of that, if you were a regular citizen of the galaxy, you'd be like, well, c'est la vie, looks like they're fighting again, wonder who our government will be next. And it to be sure, there's different degrees of oppression. Like, the Republic is preferable to the Empire, the New Republic to the First Order. But on a basic day-to-day level, it's unclear to me how much your life really would be affected by 2 years or whatever of the First Order exerting their control.
So, two things. One of them, before I forget, just because Eric, you reminded me, if listeners are interested in the concept of a, I don't know, galactic coalition trying to form, it is a classic science fiction novel, and honestly, the coolest book title of all time, The Left Hand of Darkness.
Is
about a diplomat for a, like, coalition of planets that's trying to, like, win over a new planet to join the coalition, which is, like, an alternative to my theory of conquest for the Star Wars universe. Maybe it started off really peacefully and they just wanted to, like, trade information. But no, that's a good book to sort of explore that concept. And number two, Eric, you may know the answer to this question. After seeing the Empire destroy a planet and after seeing the First Order destroy, like, a star system, like, why is there not more focus among these planets on just creating, like, some kind of planetary shield? Like, like, I don't know, when you read old science fiction stories, there was a really big atomic age focus on, I'm thinking of one from Isaac Asimov that was like, clearly they were, so first of all, they were all very anxious about nuclear weapons and that, like, dominated what they were writing about. But Asimov wrote a story about, like, a race to create, like, a shield for, like, that would stop, like, basically stop nukes, or, like, render them inert, and that, like, that would go around cities. And so, like, I'm thinking of, like, why is, clearly there's a lot of technological, I don't know, capabilities in Star Wars. There's crystals. There's all kinds of things that they could be, like, experimenting with. So I guess I'm curious if they would, if they're assuming, oh, they'll always just come up with, like, a stronger weapon, or if there's even attempts to come up with some kind of planetary defense like that, because that seems like, like, you've seen, like, a lot of people die at this point. you would think this would be a big priority.
Yeah, they never really explain if people try to do that, and if so, why it doesn't work, or if it does somewhere. My guess would just be in both of these cases, you know, with the two Death Stars, it's modified kyber crystal technology, and we know that that's what helps a lightsaber cut through anything. With Starkiller Base, it's they're literally taking the power of a sun. So I guess the argument would probably be nobody's figured out a technology that can repel something that's that powerful. Although, we know that Beskar armor can repel a regular lightsaber. Is it time for planets to start, you know, building giant Beskar, you know, dome, not domes, but spheres, you know, that enclose their planetary orbits? That might help with a Death Star. That would be like a really fun Star Wars story to see. Could a Death Star or a second Death Star punch through a Kyber, a Beskar sphere surrounding a planet? But that's the only thing I can think of. I don't know that we've ever seen technology in Star Wars that is described as being powerful enough to repel either of those types of weapons.
I just know if I was a citizen of the New Republic and just watched like trillions of people get killed by this random people who want to be the government, like that would be my first order of business for the new government.
No pun intended, I assume. Yeah.
No, it was not, but it was a good pun though.
So another thing, I'll just briefly mention this and feel free to riff on it if you want. If not, we can move on. But it is incomprehensible to me that, you know, setting aside the military question, that the New Republic was not doing more scouting to find the Imperial remnant and the people that they know got away. I mean, the thing is, you take over Coruscant, you have all these personnel records, you can start the process of finding out which of these admirals and generals have we killed or captured. Oh, by the way, there's like 60 of them, you know, I'm making up that number, but there's a ton of them out there who we just don't know where they are. That's suspicious to me, and I would, if I were the New Republic, I would simply do everything I could to find those people. We know that there are some efforts by New Republic scouts to locate what would become the First Order, but clearly they don't find them. I think it is unconscionable, if you're going to have a galactic government that takes over in this era of the bad guys getting away, you gotta go look for them everywhere. You gotta scout everywhere you possibly can. Huge intelligence failure. I think that's gotta be something that they focus on for next time.
Yeah, I think that does indicate the importance of having intelligence as some kind of intelligence apparatus. And to me, that's almost more important than having a centralized galactic military. Is we saw sort of the apparatus of the ISB and how powerful it was, but you're right, Eric, it's completely bonkers that they're just like, well, you can't catch them all. And I think in another time, perhaps the Jedi would have been well positioned to go on these individualized missions to hunt down certain folks. But yeah, now that you mention it, I've never actually thought of this, but now that you mention it, that's wild. Why didn't they do that? Did no one in the New Republic just know how to do basic spycraft? Were all of the spies bad people that then had to be rehabilitated? It's just truly baffling to me. That's a good point.
Haley, you mentioned, you know, watching the, and Grace, I think, as well, mentioned this experience of watching the Capitol get destroyed. And whether you're in the core or on the fringes of the reach of the government, there is something psychologically powerful about the destruction of the Capitol. And the New Republic, in the initial iteration, had this tradition of moving the Capitol every so often from planet to planet. Theoretically, the idea was they didn't want Coruscant to become the permanent capital and to become associated with the government, because I guess they thought that it would become too corrupt. Again, it's sort of a weird lesson to learn from the Empire. I don't think the problem of the Empire was that Coruscant itself generated or sustained the corruption. It was driven by the guy at the top. But the idea was, let's try to give more people firsthand access to their government so that it isn't this potentially, depending on where you are, distant planet that's making all the decisions, and people can actually potentially get the experience of watching it in their own backyard, although statistically there are so many planets, you're unlikely to ever see it in your lifetime. But setting that aside, do we think that tradition should continue? Is that a valuable activity in terms of combating corruption or increasing access to government? I mean, is that something that the New Republic should be spending its, you know, construction dollars on, because you got to rebuild the Senate chamber everywhere you go. Is that valuable, or is it just an empty PR exercise?
You're creating jobs, Eric.
That's true. It's an infrastructure and jobs program is what it is.
Well, I personally think that infrastructure and jobs program is silly. It doesn't really make sense to me to keep moving the capital. And yeah, it does mean that you put all of your eggs in one basket if it's in one centralized location. But there's something to be said about having a focused area in that is your center of government. It seems a lot easier than shifting around the capital every few years. And I don't necessarily think that, as you said, Eric, the empire was corrupt because it was centralized on Coruscant, or that the Republic fell because it was centralized on Coruscant. Now, that doesn't mean that I think it's a good thing to have all of your energy focused on the core and then have the outer rim totally ignored. I think there would need to be improvements, perhaps better satellite governments, perhaps capitals of different sectors. I don't know, man. But that just, it seems to me to be a really silly solution. And also, it got Hosnian Prime destroyed. So, you know, I don't think that's the way to go.
Yeah, in the High Republic era of stories that they're telling right now, which is set 200 years before the prequels, the Republic, you know, communication is much harder back then, so people don't have even as much of a connection to the central government as they do in the prequel era. And the Republic builds this giant space station called Starlight Beacon out in the outer rim, the fringes, as a way, it's sort of like a center for services. There's a Jedi temple there, so they use it as a base to go out and do missions. And it's basically the Republic's way of saying, we haven't forgotten about you. We are here to help. We have these resources on the station that are available. It's also a communications booster, so it helps people on different planets stay in touch. And it's so symbolically and functionally, it's a way of saying, hey, our capital may be all the way over there, but we're here with you too. Right, there are people here with you. And it kind of reminds me of how the post office, especially in the early American Republic, was an omnipresent sign of the federal government that helped to knit together the country by essentially creating little outposts of the federal government in far-flung places, especially places that had absolutely no connection to Washington, extremely hard to reach remote rural places. But here was the federal government in the form of the post office. And it kind of makes me think, if we're dealing with a similar problem in Star Wars, maybe we do need something like that to remind people that you're part of this and we're here for you. We can't promise that we can solve every problem you have, but we owe it to you to try. You have the right to have us try to solve your problems because you're part of this system.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
So, you know, we talked about a little bit about the Jedi, and I think, Grace, you were the one who was saying that potentially they could have been the ones going out and tracking down, you know, runaway Imperials, which would kind of be a nice inversion of the Inquisitors doing that after the fall of the Republic to the Jedi. That is, to me, one of the biggest questions that we face now in this era, which is, if Rey is going to rebuild the Jedi Order after the sequel trilogy, what should the relationship be between the government and the new Jedi Order? Should there be a formal connection? Should there be an informal connection? Should they try to stay as far apart as possible? Do we think that that's what Rey would want to do? We know that she learned at least a little bit from Luke about how the Jedi fell, and presumably he talked a little bit about the relationship between the Senate and the Jedi. So she has some inkling, and I guess she also has the sacred Jedi text, so she probably has some inkling of how things worked in the days of the Republic. What do we think? What do we think should happen here in terms of that relationship?
I think that it's best to sort of keep the Jedi and the federal government, federal galactic government, sort of like allies, but they're not explicitly working together. Because I think that was, as we've talked about in previous episodes, the Jedi fell in part because they essentially became tools of a corrupt government, and that Jedi this time around may want to maintain a healthy distance from any sort of government deployment, and certainly not be used as weapons per se. My idea of maybe having them employed as intelligence officers, that would only really work under the old Republic system. But under the new Republic system, I just think they should really just be vibing on their own, you know? I don't think that there needs to be a strong connection between the two, like maybe allies, proverbial, if the Jedi and the government were real people, they would like nod at each other when they saw each other in the hall. But I think it was bad for both the Republic and the Jedi to be so intertwined. And also, Rey just kind of strikes me as a libertarian. I don't think she would want to get super involved with the government either. But this, of course, is complete speculation.
Eric, I think we had a similar conversation a long time ago. It was an episode of just you and Mace. I'm not sure which one it was, but I'm pretty sure I was like, the Jedi should just like be teachers and open a bunch of schools, regional schools, instead of kidnapping children, and like lean into the preserving and extending knowledge to other people role. I think that would be a more useful way to spend their time than trying to be deeply involved in a government.
Yeah, and you know, part of what's hard here is that the only situation that we have an example of where there's a galactic scale war and there's an actual Jedi Order is the prequel era, where they end up becoming generals in the army. So we don't have other models of there's a war of that scale and there's an actual, you know, organization of Jedi, as opposed to just a few of them, which is what we have in the next two trilogies. I do think it's probably wise for them to be formally separate, and to not, you know, to sort of make the expectation for the Republic clear, like, we are not going to lead your troops into battle, we're not going to fight wars for you. If we see a conflict where there's a clear good and evil, and you know, the Republic is fighting to preserve a just and, you know, civil society, and whatever the other opposing force is, perhaps they're led by a Sith, perhaps they just, you know, they're just a bunch of marauders and they really just want to kill and pillage, the Jedi would probably get involved, because you're not going to sit on the sidelines. You know, you're not serving the light by just sitting in your school and saying, well, let's just hunker down and I'll keep teaching you how to lift rocks, right? I mean, what's the point of teaching you how to lift rocks if it isn't to save somebody who's, you know, trapped in the rubble, so to speak?
Well, I mean, what I would say, it could be dual purpose. Like, when you think about my favorite of the Jedi, which is Ezra, I think one of the most charming and like selfless parts of him that he grows into is just like a hyper local focus. And like his focus was on saving his planet and helping the people of his planet. And it's like, I don't know. I just think the Jedi, if they were distributed among their home planets and had like a larger infrastructure to stay where they are and to protect the people who live where they are, like, that might just be a better model.
I think in most circumstances that would work perfectly fine. The question is, what happens when we have a huge, you know, quasi-empire, quasi-First Order threat that arises? Should they just stay on their home planets and be purely defensive, or should they go on the initiative and actually try to neutralize the threat alongside the Republic, not formally working with them, but with the understanding that we're both fighting for the same thing here?
I think there's got to be a middle ground between a teacher just chilling on their home planet and instrument of the state. And I think what Haley is saying kind of gets to that about more of a localized focus. In terms of what happens if there's a really big conflict, man, why does there always just have to be a really big conflict?
It's
why
not can't they called ever just Star live happy Peace, ever after? Grace. It's called Star Wars.
You're right. That's true. If I wanted Star Peace, I could look elsewhere. I don't know, man. It feels kind of like that meme from SpongeBob where it's the fish shaking his fist and saying, "How many times do I have to teach you this lesson, old man?" Only instead of a fish, it's the various Jedi, and the old man is the First Order, Empire, Sith, whatever. Like, how many times do I have to teach you this lesson, bad guys? So, yeah, maybe there could be, if there is a sort of centralized government umbrella looking over the galaxy, and they could call up the Jedi in times of need, and then the Jedi could decide, well, what's the best way that we want to handle this? That I think makes sense, but I think I lean more towards Haley's opinion that there should be a healthy distance between a centralized Federal Republic government and the Jedi Order, such as it is.
Do we think, this is a controversial question, do we think the galaxy would be better off if, like, so many Jedi, like, flip to the dark side eventually, or, like, are tempted to go to the dark side? I don't know. Would it be better to just destroy all Force knowledge? And make that
the sacred text. Man, we got the Emperor on this podcast as a special guest.
What a can of worms. Wow, that's...
Like, do you want to kill younglings too, Haley?
No. It's more like, do we need these random spooky temples on all these planets?
I'll just say this. In the current era of the High Republic storytelling, the villains are a group of people who argue that when the Jedi use the Force to save people, they create an imbalance that ends up leading to death and destruction somewhere else to even the scales. And so their argument is when you use the Force, as opposed to just like worshiping it passively, you're corrupting the Force. You're abusing it. You're taking advantage of it. And they basically want the Jedi to stop using the Force and, you know, close themselves off from it. And they're the villains, Haley. So,
well, that's an interesting argument.
Look, I'm not saying I agree with the idea. I'm just saying maybe it should be explored.
You're just asking. Haley's just asking questions.
She's just asking. Just do your own research.
Do your own research. As folks who listen to the Hot Takes podcast know, we're not saying. We're just saying.
Well, to engage with your question seriously, I think the issue is that they're always going to find out stuff about the Force. You can't destroy it all. And we see in Rebels how there's that hidden temple, Legends of the Hidden Temple on Lothal. And there's always going to be these hidden Jedi temples everywhere. There's always going to be the sacred texts. And if you destroyed all of that, would that end this cycle? Or would that just mean that future Force users don't have the institutionalized knowledge to draw from in their own daily lives? And I think you see one of the ways that Luke struggles is because he's kind of the only Jedi trying to figure out how to rebuild an order based on like a couple books and a prayer. And it just, to lose that knowledge, I don't know if that would do anything other than make future Force users even more confused and at sea than before.
And potentially prone to that very corruption that we're trying to avoid. I mean, at least when you have an institution with, you know, people are fallible, but at least when you have an institution that is, that says that its goal is to help people harness this power for good, at least there's a place where people can go if they want to learn how to use this power for good. Some people will realize that they can lift rocks and they'll just be like, I would like to use this to throw it at car windows and throw it at people. Like, they're just vicious people and there's really no helping them. But other people will be like, wow, I can lift rocks with my mind. How do I figure out, like, how to do more things? And what do I need to know about how this works? If there's a place that they can go, at least those people will be put on the right path.
Yeah, I think it is a silly idea, and I probably wouldn't agree with it. And to give them credit, I'd like, and you probably know more about this, Eric, but it seems like they've attempted something similar for Sith knowledge, because I'm remembering in The Rise of Skywalker, C-3PO cannot speak the Sith language, and there's like a whole plot line about that, so there's like some kind of ban on that. But like, I don't know, the reason I asked the question is, one of the few Star Wars books I've read was the Darth Bane one, and he's the one who sort of comes up with the sustainable model for the Sith partnerships, which is like the rule of two. But like a huge part of his journey towards evil is having access to a like training center and school, but also he like goes and finds the Sith like temple and he learns the ancient, like, I don't know, information. And so like, I don't know, it just seems it's like an abandoned planet. It doesn't need to be there. And maybe it's just like lost knowledge that it's there to begin with, but it seems like someone should have, I don't know, nuked that out of orbit. like it shouldn't, that shouldn't exist to like radicalize people.
Yeah, I guess what we're learning here, to quote another franchise, is that with great power comes great responsibility, and power is also easily corruptible, and there is really no easy answer as to whether removing knowledge or giving full free access to knowledge is the right way to go here. So I think we're really like on the edge of some very deep ethical issues in this here Star Wars podcast.
Yeah, and again, folks, do your own research. If you find that you have the ability to lift rocks, you know, read up on exactly how you should use that power. Yeah, I mean, I think it's true that when you have something that has caused a lot of harm and a lot of pain, a lot of people are going to say, let's try to suppress this as much as possible. And ultimately, you get into a situation where, I mean, think about what ultimately turned Anakin. It was this idea that it was a lie, as far as we can tell from Palpatine, but it was a believable one, that there is a way to save your wife from death, but they won't tell you. This is like, you know, the Jedi don't want you to know. You know, Jedi hate him. He's spilling all the secrets. It's that idea of forbidden knowledge. It's inherently seductive. And so I think you don't want to be advertising, oh, if you have the Force, here are some rituals for being able to choke somebody or being able to, you know, I don't know, set a building on fire with your mind, right? You don't want to advertise that, but you also don't want to create a culture of making that alluring, of making it like, you know, I mean, think about the way that we message against drugs in the real world and how in a lot of cases that just encourages people to experiment with them because it's the forbidden fruit. We have to be very careful in Star Wars about how we do that with the Force. We don't want to encourage people to indulge in their sadistic natures, but we don't want to fuel their sadistic natures by saying, hey, we're not going to tell you about this. It's like the forbidden section in the Harry Potter library, right? When you set it up as locking away the dangerous knowledge, that's going to make it appealing. And so I think, you know, for Rey or for whoever is sort of, you know, leading this new Jedi Order, that's going to be a huge question. And, but, you know, to bring it back to the kind of New Republic question, I think it's inevitable that if there's a government, they're going to want to be involved in that conversation to some degree. They are responsible to the citizens of the galaxy for keeping them safe and providing for them. And this mystical order out there whose members or whose enemies have created and shaped these conflicts for 50 years, if not longer, they have to be, that the government has to have some role in understanding what they're doing and advising them or helping shape what they do, not necessarily to control them, but they have to be part of the conversation. So I think that on its own sets up a lot of interesting conversations. You can imagine all kinds of tension that would come out of that. You know, Grace, you kind of you hit me with this bombshell of maybe there shouldn't even be a galactic government, and it's got me thinking, if we think about the structure that the Republic and the New Republic have, and even the Empire in the early days, it's the Senate and you got the Chancellor and planets. It's very similar to the U.S. Congress, right? Planets or systems, in some cases corporations, elect people to represent them on Coruscant, and then that body makes decisions that are binding for the whole galaxy. And planets do their own things, much like U.S. states do, but there are galaxy-wide rules that are set by this representative body. And I guess my question is, and Grace, maybe I'll start with you, could we imagine a different model where we still have some kind of convening entity at the galactic level, but it does not have the same control over galactic affairs that the U.S. government has over U.S. affairs? I mean, what about some kind of version of the U.N., not exactly the shiny example of competence and efficacy, but something more like that, where they don't have the binding ability or the expectation that they will be controlling people's lives as intimately as a national government does, but they have representatives convene to try to voluntarily reach agreements on certain things that affect the whole community?
Yeah, I think that is a really interesting idea of having less of a centralized government, which could be extremely difficult to exert authority over an entire galaxy, and more perhaps of a trade coalition or a sort of NATO-esque coalition of planets, so a mutual defense agreement, which could kind of help with when those big bad troubles come along in this here Star Wars. But I do think that the idea of a sort of united planets, kind of like to mix genres, but to cross over, thinking about Starfleet in Star Trek and the system of planets and civilizations that form a sort of coalition in Star Trek, that seems to me like a form of non-government government that could make sense, allowing different planets and cultures and species to basically do their own thing while also agreeing to perhaps be in a sort of mutual defense pact or have favorable trade agreements. And Starfleet is obviously a sort of military apparatus, but I think that there is a way to have a more decentralized governance that would make sense, keeping people connected while also letting them do their own thing. And I think that Haley's mention of the Left Hand of Darkness is also an interesting idea of a model for this type of thing.
So the more I think about it, the more I am convinced that if I were in charge, I would try to be like the Lasats. Yeah. They had a bad time. Didn't they find a way to hide a planet?
They sure did.
That's what I would do. I wouldn't want people to know I existed. I would want to not be involved in all that mess.
So we have Haley, the isolationist. We have Grace, the United Federation of Planets, you know, model United Nations person. And then we have me, who's like, hey, everything's been working out so great in Star Wars. Let's just do more of it, but even more centralized and even more heavy-handed military.
Yeah, I think this all fits together.
It's called range.
No, I think actually this might be one of the areas that we've discussed on Hot Takes where we have some of the biggest disagreements about what would make the most sense. And I think that just points to the fact that, first of all, in the sequel era, they haven't done a great job of answering some of the questions that would help us figure out the best arrangement. But secondly, it's a, you know, Star Wars has done a great job of showing us the successes and failures of different systems, just like in the real world. And it's given us, you know, a lot of fodder for these types of conversations about that, you know, these are different problems in some sense than what we face in the real world. But how can we apply our knowledge of how people relate to each other to try to solve those problems? So if you're listening from a parallel universe, new Republic leadership, you know, give us a call. We would be happy to be consultants for you. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Hoth Takes. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com or find us on Twitter. We're at Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is Grace_Seegers, and Haley is Burdenator. Haley made our wonderful logo and banner art, and I edited this show and put together our music. As always, though, for legal purposes, we do want to point out that all Star Wars music, themes, sound effects, the whole nine yards, is the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes of Hoth Takes on our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com. And hey, if you like the show, please share it with a friend or family member. You can find our show on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. All right, we'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.